"Let's go a bit further," said Gandalf. And after what seemed ages further, they came suddenly to an opening where no trees grew. The moon was up and shining into the clearing. Somehow it struck all of them as not at all a nice place, although there was nothing wrong to see. And all of a sudden they heard a howl way down the hill, a long, shuddering howl. It was answered by another away to the right and a good deal nearer to them. And then by another, not far away to the left. It was wolves howling at the moon, wolves gathering together. There were no wolves living near Mr. Baggins' hole at home, but he knew that noise. He had had it described to him often enough in tales. One of his elder cousins on the Took side had been a great traveler, used to imitate it to frighten him. Now to hear it out in the forest under the moon was too much for Bilbo. Even magic rings are not much use against wolves, especially against the evil packs that lived in the shadow of the goblin-infested mountains over the edge of the wild on the borders of the unknown. Wolves of that sort smell keener than goblins, and they do not need to see you to catch you. "What shall we do? What shall we do?" he cried, "escaping goblins to be caught by wolves." He said this, and it became a proverb, though now we say out of the frying pan into the fire, in the same sort of uncomfortable situation. "Up the trees, quick," cried Gandalf, and so they ran to the trees at the edge of the glade, hunting for those that had branches fairly low or slender enough to swarm up. They found them and went as quick as ever they could, you can guess, and up they went as high as ever they could, as high as they could trust the branches. After a couple pages here, suddenly the goblins come up, yelling. They thought a battle with the woodmen was going on, but they soon learned what had really happened. Some of them actually sat down and laughed. Others waved their spears and clashed the shafts against their shields. Goblins soon had a plan which seemed to them most amusing. They had a ring of smoke. They started a ring of smoke and flame all around the dwarves, a ring which they kept from spreading outwards that closed slowly in until the running fire was licking fuel piled under the trees. Smoke was in Bilbo's eyes, and he could feel the heat of the flames, and through the reek he could see the goblins dancing round and round in a circle like people round a midsummer bonfire. Outside the ring of dancing warriors with spears and axes stood the wolves at a distance, watching and waiting. This is from J.R.R. Tolkien's book, The Hobbit, and the chapter, Out of the Frying Pan into the Fire. And what happened here was Gandalf and the hobbit Bilbo had escaped from the goblins' caves in the mountain and thought they could find a safe place by climbing up trees. But it turns out their choice of taking refuge in the trees was a really bad one. It meant that they got trapped by these wolves and goblins as they came out looking for them. And by choosing to take refuge in the trees, it made things worse for them. So it was out of the frying pan into the fire. I heard another anecdote that illustrates putting trust in the wrong place, where it was a little girl that was in school, and her teacher, the little girl's a Christian, the teacher's an atheist, and they were doing a science class on whales, and the teacher at one point said that whales have very big mouths, but they have a very small throat, and so they would never be able to swallow a human being. Well, the little girl raised her hand and said, "But the Bible said Jonah was swallowed by a whale." And the teacher kind of huffed at her that, well, you know, that's physically impossible. A whale could never swallow a human. The little girl said, "Well, then when I get to heaven, I'll ask Jonah." And the teacher said, "Well, what if Jonah went to hell?" And the little girl replied, "Well, then you can ask him." Here's another case where the teacher was seeking refuge in her own human wisdom. And as the little girl points out, it was going to only make things worse by seeking refuge in her human wisdom rather than rejecting God's Word, the Bible. It was only going to make things worse. Whenever we trust in anything besides God, it makes things worse for us. Maybe in the short term, but certainly in the long term, in eternity, in hell, if we do not trust God first. Isaiah chapter 20 is about a contrast of people one man who put his faith in God, and other people who were putting their faith in a military alliance. Let me read my translation of Isaiah chapter 20, and please follow along in your Bible. In the year that the Tartan went to Ashdod, when he was sent by Sargon, king of Assyria, and fought against Ashdod and captured her, at that time Jehovah spoke by the hand of Isaiah the son of Amoz, saying, "Go, loose the sackcloth from your waist, and take off your thong from your foot." And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. Then Jehovah said, "As my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot 3 years, a sign and portent against Egypt and against Cush, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptian captives and the Cushite exiles, children and elders, naked and barefoot, and their buttocks will be bare, the nakedness of Egypt. Then they shall be dismayed and ashamed from Cush and from their hope and from Egypt, their ornaments. And the inhabitant of this coastland will say in that day, 'Look, thus is our hope, which we escaped there for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria, and we, how shall we escape?'" As we look at Isaiah, I want to focus in on a test of faith that God gave him, and that he passed by obeying God in. And that test of faith was this word that God gave to him and said, "Now take off your clothes and your shoes and walk around naked for 3 years." Now it says to loose the sackcloth from your waist. Isaiah was wearing sackcloth at this time, and there's two reasons that I have run into for why this may have been. One was that the Assyrian king had captured the northern Israelite city of Samaria about 7 years before. And so a lot of Jewish scholars say that Isaiah was wearing sackcloth, itchy, rough fibers, kind of like if you've seen, sacks of like we make sacks out of that we put grain in or whatever, kind of like that. He was doing this as a sign of mourning over the loss of the northern kingdom. Others say this is just the garb of a prophet. In 2 Kings 18, Elisha is described as just having a leather girdle around his waist. And in Matthew 3:4, John the Baptizer is described as having a garment of camel's hair and a leather belt around his waist. So maybe this is just something that prophets kind of wore to look distinctive. I don't know. There is also some debate over whether this means really stark naked or whether it just meant that he didn't have his, maybe that he was wearing his underwear but not his outerwear, the tunic. I am inclined to think that it meant totally naked, because the Hebrew word here, arom, is used several times in the Old Testament. The phrase "naked is the day you were born" comes from the Bible. It's in Hosea 2, it's in Ecclesiastes 5, and it's in Job 1. And that's the same word used right here. And it's also the word used of Adam and Eve when they were naked and not ashamed. The Septuagint translates this word into Greek, and that same Greek word is used in John 21 to describe Peter as he was stripped for doing his fishing work in his fishing boat. People figure Peter was probably not totally naked to work, but maybe he had just thrown out his overgarment and then he threw his tunic on and jumped into the sea when he saw Jesus on the land. But whatever the case is here, This was a shameful thing. It was supposed to look shameful. It was supposed to cause shame. God intended it for a sign for the Israelites to feel the same kind of blush and shame that they would feel when the king of Assyria paraded the captives of Egypt before the people of Jerusalem, and the people of Jerusalem realized all hope was lost. It was that kind of shame and horror that God wanted the people of Israel, of Jerusalem, to feel when they saw Isaiah. Now, this was a test of faith for Isaiah to perform a really out-on-the-edge sort of sign like this without actually knowing what was going to happen. Isaiah had to take off his clothes and walk around and say, well, this is because you're going to be really ashamed in 3 years. But Isaiah had no way of knowing for sure whether in 3 years this was really going to come true. This was a hard test of faith. What if it didn't come true? What if he misunderstood God or something? What would happen to his reputation? Can you imagine? Yeah, he was the guy that walked around naked for 3 years and his prophecy didn't come true. he would definitely no longer be someone anybody would trust or respect anymore, would he? But yet it says in verse 2, he did it. He obeyed God. Isaiah passed this test of faith and he obeyed God, as hard as it must have been. Would you have obeyed God if God had told you to do something that crazy? If you were sure it was God's will, would you have obeyed? Sometimes God teaches us to do things that just don't make sense. He says, love your enemy, do good to those that hate you and that despitefully use you. That doesn't make sense. And our human judgment, we want to, we want to get revenge. But God says, no, you do it this way. And that is what faith is all about. In Hebrews 11, it says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the confidence of things not seen. That is the essence of faith, is doing something that you cannot see, living based on something you cannot see and that you cannot prove scientifically is going to happen. The famous commentator on Isaiah, E.J. Young, wrote, acting in obedience to God can never be a thing of shame. Acting in obedience to God can never be a thing of shame. So what was the result of Isaiah's obedience in this test of faith? When you think of Isaiah, well, before I told you, before we read this chapter, what did you think of Isaiah? What kind of reputation did he have in your mind? Did you think of him as a gross nudist weirdo? No, you think of him as one of the greatest prophets. In the preface to John Calvin's commentary on Isaiah, he says, Isaiah is called the most sublime and elegant of the prophets of the Old Testament. Elegant. The most sublime and elegant. That's the kind of reputation Isaiah has. Isaiah stepped out on a limb and obeyed God, risking his reputation in a major way. And God blessed him for it. In the long run, his reputation is that of the most sublime and elegant prophet in the Bible, in the Old Testament. His faith did not result in destroying his reputation. His obedience to God and doing something that didn't make sense did not destroy him. Rather, God honored him. In John chapter 12, verse 26, at the end of that verse, it says, if anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. If you've watched the movie Chariots of Fire, that piece of paper that Eric Little had in his hands as he ran that Olympic race in the year 1924 had that Bible verse on it. His massage therapist saw Eric take a stand like this. He saw Eric had trained for years to run the 100-meter race. And then he got to the Olympics, or on his way to the Olympics, he found out that the race was scheduled for a Sunday. And because that was what he considered his regular, that was his work and something that he would not do on a Sunday, he refused to run the race that he had trained for and the race that he could have won in the Olympics, even though men all the way up to the Prince of Wales of England came to him and said, "You should run this race." He chose to obey God rather than man. And his massage therapist saw and was inspired as he saw Eric make this decision. And so he wrote this verse out on a piece of paper and gave it to Eric to show his respect for him. "He who honors me, I will honor." And Eric enrolled in the 400-meter race instead, a race he had not trained for, and won the gold medal. God honored him, even though he stepped out on a limb and did something that everyone thought was foolish, to not run the race he had trained for. God honored him because he honored God, and he was willing to obey God rather than men. Now let's look at the contrast. Let's look at what was going on and what people were trusting in at the time of this prophecy. Why was this sign given to Isaiah to show to the people of Israel? What was wrong with them? They were trusting in man instead of trusting in God. And I want to just go through a quick history of the events that were going around in this time that will kind of help put everything into context, I hope, for you. I'm going to pass around a picture here that's got a map of Israel and some of the military campaigns of the Assyrians that were coming down out of this corner. And here there are two things in the passage of Isaiah. What's really amazing is archaeologists have found historical records from the Assyrians that date right to this time of Isaiah. And the Assyrians recorded things with text and pictures. And so we've got actual pictures from this time, engravings. The top one's in copper and the bottom one is in stone. But engravings from the very kings that are being talked about here in Isaiah. One of them is an engraving of Sargon and the Tartan. And these are the people that are mentioned right here in Isaiah 20. This was set in Sargon's palace that he built up in Assyria in Carsabad. This up here is actually from Sargon's predecessor, Shalmaneser. He built another palace in Bulawat that had these big wooden doors, and he had coppersmiths punch engravings of his military exploits along with written historical records up along the top of them. So this is one of these copper plates that had been used to decorate the front gates of Shalmaneser. So I'm going to pass this around, and notice these captives along here. There's some men, there's the Assyrian soldier on a horse and another Assyrian soldier, and you've got three men right here, and you'll notice that they are naked, and then there are women in front of them. This is exactly the kind of thing that the Assyrians did. Now then, while that's being passed around, I want to kind of show the flow of what's going on historically. If I put it there, that way you can all see. Does that work? Okay. Well, let's see. Let's get our areas in here first. We've got the Mediterranean Sea here. All right, and around here.
here is Tyre. And this is Phoenicia. All right, along in here is Jerusalem. I'm just going to put a J. And this is Judea in here. Or Judah. This is the southern kingdom of Israel. Samaria is up here. And this would be Ephraim. Then along the coastline here, you've got several Philistine cities. Just all along here, and some coming up towards the hills of Judah.
I have to double check my notes here.
We've got Elteca, which is also known as Azotus. Got Lachish, Ashdod, Gaza, and down into Egypt, there's Raphia. So Egypt is down here, and this is Cilicia here. Where to strike that? Okay. Then up here is Damascus, Syria. So this is Syria up here. And down here is Moab. Moab's pretty much, it's got kind of the whole Transjordan area at this point in time. And then on out here, maybe it'll be a little further west, east than this, is Nineveh and Assyria. Okay? Phoenicia is connected with, over here we've got the Hittites and the Greeks
coming on around. So this is kind of a setup.
And what's happening at this point, if I just run over the events of about 100 years
between the year 728, not quite, it's about 50 years, 728 down to the year about 700, down into 6 about 675, something like that. About 50 years,
50 year sweep of history. This is what happened.
Where did I put my pen? There it is.
Okay. We start out earlier in Isaiah. Ahaz, remember, Ahaz, the king of Judah, down here, he found out that Ephraim and Syria were allying together to fight him. And so what did Ahaz do? Huh? He formed an alliance with Assyria. Okay? So with Assyria and Judah against Syria and Ephraim. And so the Assyrians came down and they conquered Syria and Ephraim and made Syria and Ephraim pay tribute to them. Then a new dynasty came up down here in Egypt. A new king, the 25th dynasty, and Shabaka, or there's different permutations of that name. He became king over all upper and lower Egypt, and was a strong king. And so all of these peoples around here, as they realized, we're not so sure we like a strong Assyrian army, they all started realigning with Egypt in order to get some protection against Assyria. Tyre, Ephraim, Hoshea was the last king of Ephraim, and he made an alliance with Egypt. Hezekiah was king down here, he made an alliance, and let's see, what else happened in this at this point? Okay, so the Assyrians, as everyone starts realigning over here, the Assyrians come back in order to regain control of the area. They come down to Moab first, then they capture Samaria, and then they come down here and they capture this whole area, to down to the border of Egypt. And that way, Assyria is able to control this whole corridor between Assyria and Egypt. At that time, they put on the throne here in one of the Philistine cities a governor named Achimati. I'll maybe talk some more about that next Sunday. Well, once Assyria had taken all this, the king of Tyre said, this isn't going to work. He's still in alliance with Egypt, and he doesn't like the Assyrians controlling the ground in between them. So the king of Tyre, Eulalius, came down to this area, and I think he worked in concert with Hezekiah, because Hezekiah, it also talks about Hezekiah taking fortified cities. I think that they may have actually worked together to reconquer this area. And as a result, a Greek man who was probably affiliated with Phoenicia's ties back up this way was put on the throne of one of these Philistine cities, replacing Achimati. Make sure I don't miss anything now. It's during this time that, this Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, says, no, I don't like that. I want to keep this area, but in order to get there, I'm going to have to conquer Tyre first. So he comes to Tyre and begins a five-year campaign trying to besiege Tyre, and we'll get into that in a few more weeks. Then he goes back because there's some trouble on the other border with the Medes and Persians that he has to take care of. So he's not able to immediately come out and take care of this situation where that Hezekiah and Phoenicia had been captured. But it's still in the back of his mind, so he sends his number two man. The word Tartan apparently means two, second, and the Assyrian language. So he sends the Tartan to come down here and try to bring this into order and recapture this area. It's at this point that Hezekiah gets scared, and he tries to pay some tribute to the king of Assyria in order for the Tartan won't take him over. And he works on fortifying Jerusalem, and God lets him get sick, mortally ill. He's going to die, perhaps because he's trying to trust in his own stratagems to save himself from the king of Assyria. When Hezekiah repents and asks God to save him, God says, okay, I'll give you 15 more years of life, and you will see Jerusalem delivered from the Assyrians. As the Tartan is coming down, this Greek man, Emanu, flees south into Egypt to escape because he knows he's going to be a hot target for the Tartan. He flees south to Egypt. Well, the king of Egypt doesn't want to be caught harboring a rebel from Assyria, so he puts Emanu in chains and returns him back up here for the Assyrian army to take. But the town of Lachish, especially, is taking a long time to conquer. They've besieged it for years and years. So the Sennacherib or Sargon, and I think the two are the same person. I'm fairly convinced. Realizes he's going to have to bring the rest of his army down and help the Tartan finish off this area. So he does come down. They've got this huge army. They initially conquer this area and head down into Egypt and conquer Egypt and then head back and refortify here in these Philistine cities. Then they're about to attack Judah, Jerusalem, from here, and then they hear that the king of Ethiopia lower down is coming up, Tirhaka. So he fires off a threat to Hezekiah and goes down to meet Tirhaka in battle here in Egypt. He whoops them and then comes back and camps in front of Jerusalem and threatening to besiege Jerusalem. And it's at that point that the angel of the Lord, Hezekiah falls on his face before God. The angel of the Lord comes and strikes 185,000 of the soldiers, and Sennacherib retreats back to Assyria. And just as an epilogue to set some of the other things that I have mentioned in past sermons into this perspective, Sennacherib continues to fight Medes and Persians for the next 14 years. Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, succeeds Hezekiah, and it is believed that he martyred Isaiah by putting him in a log and sawing him in half. Then, after that, after Manasseh became king here, and he was king for a long time, then we had the civil disorder down in Egypt, which resulted in the 12 kings separating the Egypt up into pieces, and then one of those 12, Psammaticus, coming and taking control again over all of Egypt. And he was the hard king that was mentioned earlier in Isaiah. So that's kind of trying to give a sweep of about the 50-year span of history in which Isaiah is prophesying. As you can see, these political alliances were huge. There was a war going on. Assyria was trying to conquer the world. And all of these peoples right in here were doing their best to try to stop them. The Assyrians were incredibly strong and powerful. And the people were very understandably tempted to look to these other armies, especially to this large country of Egypt below them, to give them a little help. Verse 6, then, speaks of all the inhabitants of this coastland, and that's talking about all of these, the Phoenicians, the Philistines, as well as the people of Israel, all of them together. And including Israel in as much as they place their trust in men rather than in God. All of these inhabitants will say, thus is our hope. We escaped there to Egypt for help, and now they're being led captive back naked. And now what are we going to do? How shall we escape from these Assyrian armies? Isaiah, we're going to see in subsequent chapters of Isaiah, Isaiah 31, God says, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help. And in Isaiah 36, 6-9, we have the taunt of the Tartan when he comes up to Jerusalem and says, how can you trust in Egypt? They're unpredictable and untrustworthy. And what he said was true. Jeremiah 46, God says, I'm bringing punishment upon the Pharaoh and upon all who trust in him. They, again, were in a out of the frying pan into the fire sort of experience. As they trusted, the more they trusted in Egypt and other political powers, the more trouble they got into. Until they were eventually, their back was to the wall,
Assyrians had conquered everything in Israel except for the city of Jerusalem, and they were under siege, and there was no way that they were going to win that one. We trusted in Egypt. Now what are we going to do? How shall we escape? So here's the contrast of these two people. Isaiah, who trusted God and whose faith was rewarded, who risked his reputation and in the long run gained a stellar reputation. And the people of the coastland here, who trusted in political alliances and ended up with their back against the wall and unable to escape. God's call to us is the same. It is, how are you going to escape? And you, how will you escape? What happens when you run up against something, a danger that is bearing down on you? What happens when God asks you to do something crazy and to exercise faith in Him? Are you going to be like Isaiah, or are you going to be like the people of the coast? God sends faith-testing trials on us, and we can't see God. We can't see everything that He's doing. We don't know the future. People look so powerful. We can feel so helpless in the face of danger. And God's ways don't usually look like they'll work. You look down the path of some of these things the Bible teaches us to do, and you can see down the path a certain distance before it turns off and out of sight. And it certainly looks like it's going the wrong direction. But if you've gotten nothing else out of the book of Isaiah, you should have at least gotten this, that God is big and He's nothing to be trifled with. He's worth trusting. God promises blessing to those who will trust Him and will follow His paths. He sent His Son Jesus to be born for us and to die for us, to take on the punishment for sin and rise from the dead for us. This is God's news that He wants us to believe and tell other people about. What result do you want to see in your life? As God puts the test of faith, are you going to trust in Jesus? Are you going to trust in God's ways? Or are you going to look to your own strength or to the help of other people in order to help you in the fears and the challenges that you face? Which do you want? The short-term ridicule that Isaiah faced for following God? The long-term ridicule that was figured by Isaiah? Do you want that long-term ridicule of, you know, you'll be dismayed and ashamed from your hope, or the short-term ridicule of doing something that God wants you to do that is that may bring some short-term ridicule from other people who don't understand and don't see the big picture? What do you want in the long term? The long-term shame or the long-term good reputation, like Isaiah had? The honor of being faithful. Which do you want, the army of Egypt or the Lord of hosts on your side? That is the challenge that God places before us, too. Just as it was placed before Isaiah, just as it was placed before the people in the midst of all this political upheaval. Dwight Moody said, if you trust in yourself, you're doomed to disappointment. If you trust in your friends, they will die and leave you. If you trust in your reputation, some slanderous tongue may blast it. But trust in God and you will never be confounded in time and eternity. Martin Luther said, I've held many things in my hands and I've lost them all. But whatever I've placed in God's hands, that I still possess. It is in God's hands that we need to place our trust. We need to be willing to do whatever God calls us to do, and God calls us to a test of faith, in a test of faith. In the going back to the story in The Hobbit, there is a happy ending. Howl of anger and surprise from the goblins. Loud cried the Lord of the Eagle, to whom Gandalf had now spoken. Back swept the great birds that were with him, and down they came like huge black shadows. The wolves yammered and gnashed their teeth, and the goblins yelled and stamped with rage and flung their heavy spears in the air in vain. Over them swooped the eagles. The dark rush of their beating wings smote them to the floor, drove them far away. Their talons tore at their faces. Other birds flew to the treetops and seized the dwarves, who were scrambling now up as far as they dared to go. This may not be a perfect analogy, but it was from an outside source. It was from above that they were rescued. When they had made all their bad choice, climbed up these trees and gotten trapped, there was an outside source of rescue that came that they could not have seen or foreseen. And that is a figure, a symbol of God's salvation. God comes down when we can't see what He's doing, and from above He comes and saves us. That is the answer to how shall we escape. It's by trusting God. That's what happened when King Hezekiah, when his back was against the wall, and Sargon or Sennacherib had conquered everything and was focusing his final battle on the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was under siege and there was no hope for it. When Hezekiah put his trust in God, God delivered him miraculously. The answer, how shall we escape, to the question, how shall we escape, is trust God. And so I just end by putting the question to you. You, how shall you escape from whatever fears and threats you face? Trust God.